poor immigrant populations crowding into American cities in the late 19th century. Where her father exercised his benevolence at a distance, Alta rolled up her sleeves, went into the slums, and administered self-help programs for the poor. At 10th Avenue and 55th Street in Manhattan, she set up a sewing school for indigent girls, drafted a corps of volunteer teachers, and enrolled 125 pupils. She also set up a small private clinic for invalid women. Despite her managerial talents, Alta departed from her father's penchant for building large institutions and favored small-scale charities, of which the best example was Alta House in Cleveland. In the 1890s, a local minister interested Rockefeller and his daughter in a charity, the Day Nursery and Free Kindergarten Association, serving poor Italian immigrants in the Murray Hill District, the Little Italy of Cleveland. Many working couples left their children there during the day. Rockefeller agreed to construct a new settlement building, Alta House, which was dedicated in February 1900 and furnished with a family laundry and medical dispensary. Although he supplied the money and covered the budget for its first 20 years, Alta did the legwork. She enjoyed direct contact with the immigrant families and took special delight in dressing up dolls for their children. After completion of the settlement house, Alta was desperately eager to marry. When Edith married Harold McCormick in 1895, Alta was openly envious and told her brother that, "I must try to enter heartily into all her happiness." Through Harold McCormick, Alta met Ezra Parmalee Prentice, then working in Chicago as general counsel for the Illinois Steel Company. Cold and smart, a rigid perfectionist, Parmalee was also an amateur scientist with a large collection of meteorological instruments. The scion of an old Albany family and a graduate of Amherst College and Harvard Law School, he underwent the same microscopic scrutiny that awaited any supplicant for Alta's hand. As she told Junior in early 1900, Parmalee gave Father the names of four of his friends who would answer any questions about him that Father might want to ask, and said that he would add to this list if it were desired. When Parmalee passed muster, he and Alta were married the following year, but Parmalee and Senior had a remote relationship and seldom saw each other. Parmalee penned formal letters to his father-in-law that began, "Dear Mr. Rockefeller," and were signed E. Parmalee Prentice. Unlike Edith, Alta wanted to live near her parents. Perhaps Parmalee erred by abandoning his Chicago job to practice law in New York and join a firm that would one day evolve into Milbank, Tweed, Hadley, and McCloy. Surrendering his freedom by slow degrees, he allowed Junior to buy and furnish a new home for them at 5 West 53rd Street. A gift from Senior, this house stood behind his own home on West 54th Street. "Uncle John did furnish that house," one of Alta and Parmalee's children said. "My father could not have cared less, and my mother did not have the know-how. She had grown up in the same rut as Uncle John and had no one to pull her out. She was timid, spiritual like her mother, and besides, she had the idea that her brother always knew best." Parmalee had a fine legal mind, authored two legal books, and argued cases before the Supreme Court. At first, Rockefeller referred legal work to him and advised other moguls to follow suit, but he never got the expected gratitude from his proud son-in-law. In 1905, when Rockefeller asked him to reorganize Colorado Fuel and Iron, he was not only outraged by the fees Parmalee charged, but indignant at his high-handed treatment of the bondholder representatives. At that point, Rockefeller advised Gates to refer less business to Parmalee's firm. Unable to compromise on business principles, Rockefeller chose to jeopardize family relations instead. Instead of distributing money to his children at maturity, Rockefeller kept them on allowances after they married and reserved the right to oversee their finances. Junior was appointed family auditor, and this turned him perforce into an irritating, censorious presence in the lives of his three brothers-in-law. When Junior decided in 1904 that Alta and Parmalee were spending twice as much as their income warranted, Parmalee bristled at this intrusion into their private lives. The prodigal generosity displayed by Senior after Alta's wedding now turned into its opposite, and she was placed in the demeaning position of having to beg him for money. After a point, she did not disguise her anger. 10 years ago, when we came into the house, you were good enough to pay for all the lace curtains, she wrote to her father. These curtains are now worn out, and I have bought new ones. Would you help me out by buying the curtains? If so, I shall be greatly pleased. If not, of course it will be all right. Once he had made them feel punished for earlier extravagance, Senior would relent and disperse the money. As long as the right conditions were met, this controlling father was always happy to be generous. In 1910, he offered Alta and Parmalee $250,000 to purchase a house and land, and they bought a 1,000-acre farm, which they christened Mount Hope, in the Berkshire Mountains near Williamstown, Massachusetts. It is interesting that both Alta and Bessie married cold, remote, self-absorbed men. One can speculate that they chose these men because of their resemblance to their father. Yet neither Charles Strong nor Parmalee Prentice had Rockefeller's redeeming cordiality or spontaneous interest in other people. Many observers felt that Alta had blundered in marrying the autocratic Parmalee. Priggish and straight-laced, he demanded that their three children dress formally for dinner each night, and he never allowed them to bring friends to the table. Highly cerebral, Parmalee translated Treasure Island into Latin and insisted that the children converse with him in Latin each evening. Each Sunday he prepared an essay on a theme and led a family discussion. Parmalee was so fearsome a father that even Junior's children felt their own home positively wild and decadent in comparison. Whatever her frustrations, Alta put the best face on the marriage. Parmalee is beautiful in his thoughts for me and his consideration of me, and if he had his way, nothing would ever be allowed to fret me nor disturb me for one single minute, she wrote to her father. He makes my life one long, glad song. While Parmalee had rather cool relations with his children, Alta insisted to her father that they love him as dearly and respect him so much that they cannot bear to see even the slightest shadow cross his face. The compliment can also be read to connote a certain fear that the children had of him. After purchasing the farm, Alta and her husband increasingly inhabited a rural world, tramping about the muddy fields and growing corn, oats, potatoes, buckwheat, and Macintosh apples. Alta's letters abound in talk of plowing, threshing, and manure. Prompted by an interest in Gregor Mendel's genetic studies, Parmalee began to experiment with scientific agriculture and studied ways to boost the output of their potato crop, dairy herd, and hens. Visitors to Mount Hope were far more likely to meet geneticists from Williams College than society figures. When Parmalee organized an experiment to cross black and white mice, Alta had to photograph 1,000 mice. Where Edith had ventured out into the world, Alta, who had little contact with her sister, stuck to a simple life that revolved around her husband, children, farm, and horses. Senior wanted all three sons-in-law, along with Junior, to be involved in the Rockefeller philanthropies. For reasons discussed later, he skipped over his three daughters. Senior and Junior made intermittent efforts to interest Parmalee, but he habitually declined their offers. At one point, Harold McCormick tried to relieve tensions between Junior and Parmalee, while admitting to Senior that Parmalee had a proud and perhaps even haughty spirit. Harold maintained that he was a good-hearted man who suffered from a feeling on the part of the harsh world that he is discredited by his family or even viewed with indifference. Citing the hostility between Junior and Parmalee, Harold added, "Alta is torn almost in two in her love." Apparently, Senior was not convinced. Soon after Harold's plea, he complained to Edith that Junior was overburdened with charitable work and explicitly blamed his sons-in-law. "I could wish that Harold and Parmalee, with their broad shoulders, were heart and soul in this work with us." Yet it was never clear how they could do that without subordinating their identities to Rockefeller, who never understood their need for freedom from his domineering presence. While Parmalee craved distance from Senior, he did not renounce the financial rewards that came with the relationship. In 1912, Rockefeller guaranteed him a $30,000 annual income from his legal work. If he failed to reach that level, Rockefeller would make up the difference. Whether Parmalee suddenly grew lazy or suffered a sharp downturn in business is unclear. But 2 years later, Rockefeller had to pay $26,000 of his salary. 2 years after that, he doubled Parmalee's annual guaranteed salary to $60,000. Meanwhile, Alta's annual allowance was boosted to $50,000 in 1914. By transferring more money to Alta and Parmalee and giving them the means to pay their own bills, Rockefeller hoped to end the constant tussles between them and Junior over money, something that he should have done in the first place. Chapter 22. Avenging Angel. The relief that washed through Standard Oil after William McKinley's 1896 election had proved short-lived. Despite a sudden upsurge of prosperity, the electorate remained wary of the new monopolies and the muscular arrivistes who had created them. The crusade to curtail the trusts was very much alive, if temporarily shunted to the state level. Once again, the first salvo against Standard Oil was fired in Ohio. The state attorney general, Frank Manette, successor to the crusading David K. Watson, was the son of a Methodist preacher, a former railroad attorney, and a hard-working public servant. In 1897, he received a visit from the maverick refiner George Rice, who persuaded him that Standard Oil had never complied with the 1892 decision to sever Ohio Standard from the trust. To check up on his adversaries, Rice had bought 6 shares of Standard Oil trust certificates. When he tried to redeem them for fractional shares in the 20 constituent companies spun off by the 1892 decision, the liquidating trustees, including Rockefeller, procrastinated for 4 years. Now, 5 years after the verdict, $27 million in trust certificates remained unredeemed. On November 9, 1897, Monette charged that Standard of Ohio had never seriously planned to leave the trust and was in contempt of court. It had all been a charade to pacify trustbusters. Rockefeller's retirement began to assume the inexorable nature of a Greek tragedy. Just as he sought to extricate himself from the trust, its legal troubles deepened. Conditioned by a long history of Standard Oil mendacity, both press and public mocked his so-called retirement as a tawdry ruse to evade testimony. It defied the common conception of villainy to think that such a man could simply walk away from his creation. To expedite the case, Monette had a master commissioner interrogate witnesses in New York. On October 11, 1898, Rockefeller was summoned to testify at the New Amsterdam Hotel, the prosecution hoping to prod him into an admission that he had stalled in liquidating the trust. Through more than 5 hours of questioning, Rockefeller, as imperturbable as ever, spoke in such a low voice that people strained to hear him, and he conceded so little that the next day's World ran the headline, "Rockefeller imitates a clam." Standard lawyers spent much more time objecting to questions than Rockefeller did in answering them. Once again, he presented the past as a dense fog that he could scarcely penetrate. As the World dryly observed, "The virtue of forgetting, which is one of the most valuable virtues that a monopolist can have under cross-examination, is possessed by Mr. Rockefeller in its highest degree." Rockefeller, as always, refused to believe that anybody could have a legitimate objection to Standard Oil. Once again, he fell back on his all-purpose explanation that the suits filed against him were just extortion rackets posing as public service. Later on, he said that Monette's motive was to blackmail the Standard Oil Company and that he was a comrade in schemes with George Rice. Rockefeller suppressed signs of irritation at the hearing, yet he seemed edgier than on earlier occasions. Reporters noted telltale nervous habits that called into question his surface composure. The way he kept shifting his weight, crossing and recrossing his legs, rubbing his nape, blowing out his cheeks, and biting his mustache. At the end of his testimony, Rockefeller, discernibly relieved, did something very unusual for him. He bounded straight over to George Rice, extended his hand, and tried to engage him in conversation. He suddenly grew very chatty, as two newspapers reported. "How are you, Mr. Rice? We are getting to be old men now, eh? Don't you wish you had taken my advice years ago?" "Perhaps it would have been better for me if I had," said Rice, glaring at him. "You have ruined my business as you said you would."
"Pshaw, pshaw," replied Rockefeller, moving away.
"You did. You ruined me," persisted Rice, chasing him. Rice, a well-to-do businessman, perhaps overstated his case.
"Pshaw, pshaw," said Rockefeller, donning his silk hat.
"I would rather have given 10—"
"It's no use your saying pshaw," Rice interrupted. "You know damned well you did."
Rockefeller flashed a funereal smile, then disappeared from the room. It was one of the few times in his mysterious career that he ever confronted one of his nemeses. If Rockefeller's style was to slip away from attacks, the Monette investigation displayed the two-fisted style of his successor, John D. Archbold. On the stand, Archbold accused Rice of trying to extort $500,000 from Standard Oil for his refinery, and at the lunch recess, according to one newspaper, he marched up to Rice, jabbed a finger in his face, and said, "You are nothing but wind and weight." "And you," retorted Rice, "are nothing but money stolen from the people." The impetuous Archbold behaved as if public opinion were of no importance. He did not see that the day of reckoning for Standard Oil was fast approaching, and he would soon need all the friends he could get. In a preview of his brawling, arrogant style with authorities, Archbold got into a heated shouting match with a man named Flagg, one of Monette's assistants. "You keep still or I'll expose you right here," Archbold shouted at him.
"You couldn't if you tried," said Flagg. "I'm not afraid of your millions."
"Shut up or I will show you up," cried Archbold.
"Is anyone low-lived compared with a Standard Oil magnate?"
"You know what you are."
"You are a coward and a liar," shouted Flagg.
"You are a stinking liar," Archbold shot back.
What prompted this vehement exchange was the burning of company records at a Standard Oil facility in Cleveland. Monette had charged Standard of Ohio with surreptitiously paying dividends to holders of trust certificates after 1892, which Rockefeller and other officials denied. To resolve the matter, the state Supreme Court ordered Standard of Ohio to produce its books in December 1898. 2 weeks later, reports filtered out that 16 boxes of books had been incinerated by Standard employees. Amid a national furor, Standard attorneys denied that the boxes contained the ledgers in question. "From time to time," said Standard Oil's attorney, Virgil Klein, "the company destroyed useless material which accumulates in its business." But he refused to produce the pertinent ledgers. Monette thought the books were torched to shield Rockefeller. As he told Henry Demarest Lloyd, "I am of the opinion that the books were burned, at least in part. They were obliged to either let the books contradict Mr. Rockefeller or take a defiant stand and conceal the books from the court." Among other damning accusations, Standard Oil was said to have hired the Malcolm Jennings Advertising Agency to promote its products in Ohio and Indiana newspapers in exchange for favorable news items. The most sensational charge trumpeted by Monette involved an alleged attempt by Standard Oil to bribe him into dropping the case, much as had been alleged with David K. Watson. Monette said that a nameless emissary had come to his Columbus office with an offer of $400,000. The money was to be left in a safety deposit box in New York, with Monette given the key. Standard attorneys hotly disputed this, demanding the name of their putative agent. When Monette would not identify him, citing fears of reprisals, it cast doubt on the story. In a later statement, he named Fergus Charles Haskell and Frank Rockefeller as the culprits. Rockefeller's papers, unfortunately, shed no light on the situation. Before Monette could inflict lasting damage upon Standard Oil, he became persona non grata in many sections of his own Republican Party. He especially incurred the wrath of U.S. Senator Joseph B. Foraker of Ohio, who was on the Standard Oil payroll.
In 1900 alone, Archbold disbursed $44,500 in lobbying fees to the senator. At a Washington meeting, Foraker gave Monette a brief but unforgettable education in Ohio political realities. As Monette recreated the discussion, "I had first discussed the impropriety and danger of Foraker's representing these trusts, criminal and civil violators of his own state, as long as he, as well as myself, should be interested in the welfare of the people of Ohio. He told me that he never allowed his law practice to interfere with politics or his politics with law practice, and added that he was a judge of ethics of our profession. He then took up the cause of action against these companies and reminded me of the great power financially and politically of the Standard Oil crowd. After talking a short time, he asked me to have the proceedings delayed in order to accommodate him. I firmly declined to concede any time whatever and told him so. He recalled the great power of the oil trust to anyone who opposed it." True to Foraker's warning, Monette failed to win the Republican renomination for Attorney General in 1899. Disillusioned, he joined the Democratic Party 2 years later. Even though the Ohio suit fizzled, it alerted the trust to the need for a permanent corporate structure that could weather legal challenges. Ever since 1892, Standard Oil had sustained a precarious arrangement in which 17 leading shareholders, many of them the liquidating trustees, held a majority of the stock of 20 constituent companies. These oil industry veterans were now graying. Archbold, in his early 50s, was among the youngest. And since they alone bound the Standard Oil units together, they feared that if they died, their heirs might squabble, sell the shares, or otherwise threaten the trust's cohesion. It was time for a less shaky corporate framework. The trust had long struggled with the legal straitjacket that prevented companies from holding stock in out-of-state corporations. In 1898, heeding the clamor against the trusts, Congress created the U.S. Industrial Commission to study the American economy. Testifying before that body a year later, Rockefeller bemoaned this legal anachronism. "Our federal form of government, making every corporation created by a state foreign to every other state, renders it necessary for persons doing business through corporate agency to organize corporations in some or many of the different states in which their business is located." To rectify the problem, Rockefeller endorsed a federal incorporation law, even if a measure of government regulation came with it. In the meantime, Standard Oil was aided by recent amendments to the New Jersey incorporation law. In June 1899, undergoing yet another change in form, Standard Oil became a full-fledged holding company under New Jersey law, with the legal parent, Standard Oil of New Jersey, controlling stock in 19 large and 22 small companies. Though he owned more than one-fourth of the shares, Rockefeller wanted to stay retired and avoid operational responsibility. Loath for him to relinquish his titular leadership amid legal troubles, his colleagues insisted that he remain honorary president. "I declined to have any official position in the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey in 1899. Rockefeller later told Harold McCormick, "and urged my brother William to take this position, but as he declined and all the others were very urgent, I was called the president and have been since, although the position is and has all the time been entirely nominal." Unbeknownst to the general public, Rockefeller never attended a meeting or drew a salary, and Archbold, the new vice president, ran the organization. In many respects, Standard Oil attained its peak influence in the 1890s. It now marketed 84% of all petroleum products sold in America and pumped a third of its crude oil, the highest percentage it ever reached. After years of harrowing prophecies that the industry might vanish, the business outlook had never looked brighter, despite the growing use of electricity. Sales boomed in everything from oil stoves to parlor lamps to varnish, soaking up oil supplies and driving up prices. In 1903, the British Navy outfitted some battleships to use fuel oil instead of coal, attracting the notice of the U.S. Navy. Paraffin wax had become a vital insulator in the burgeoning telephone and electrical industries.
Most momentous of all, the automobile promised to consume that vile, useless byproduct, gasoline, and Standard Oil cultivated the new car makers. When Henry Ford rolled out his first vehicle, Charlie Ross, a Standard Oil salesman, stood by with a can of the Trust's Atlantic Red Oil. The number of registered automobiles in America leaped from 800 in 1898 to 8,000 in 1900. When the Wright brothers took off from Kitty Hawk in 1903, their flight was powered by gasoline brought to the beach by Standard Oil salesmen. These new petroleum applications more than offset the dwindling kerosene business. Though it had some scrappy competition at home from Pure Oil, Standard Oil's monopoly seemed secure in the 1890s. But developments at home and abroad soon imperiled its power even before Teddy Roosevelt's trustbusters entered the scene. In the late 1890s, Russia temporarily surpassed the United States to become the world's largest crude oil producer, capturing 35% of the world market. The Trust's global monopoly was sharply eroding on other fronts. The new Burma Oil sold oil actively in Indian markets. Royal Dutch expanded its drilling in Sumatra, and Shell Transport and Trading stepped up its East Asian activities. In October 1901, Sir Marcus Samuel of Shell held secret talks at 26 Broadway. Archbold reported to Rockefeller, "This company, Shell, represents by all means the most important distributing agency for refined oil throughout the world, outside of our own interests. He is here undoubtedly to take up with us the question of some sort of an alliance, preferably on his part of the sale to us of a large interest in their company." 2 months later, afraid of ceding too much power to Archbold, Samuel signed an agreement instead with Henry Detterding of Royal Dutch, creating a major new alliance along with the French Rothschilds. Archbold responded to this new threat with unrelenting price wars. The home situation had grown no less treacherous. In 1900, the Waters Pierce Company, Standard Oil's rogue marketing subsidiary, was ousted from Texas for violating the state's antitrust law. It had cornered 90% of the oil market, winning universal infamy for its cutthroat sales practices. This legal setback mattered greatly, for it evicted the Trust from the state on the eve of a revolution. In 1901, drillers in Beaumont, Texas, made a major find in a dreary mound called Spindletop, which spouted oil with such explosive force that it spewed tens of thousands of barrels into the air for days before it was capped. The Texas oil boom, which spawned 500 new companies during its first year alone, redrew the industry map. By 1905, Texas accounted for more than a quarter of the crude oil being pumped in America. Popular antagonism towards Standard Oil in Texas prevented the Trust from moving aggressively to exterminate these new competitors, though the Trust did have several refining affiliates there. When the Mellons, who had financed Spindletop, offered to sell it to Standard Oil, they were bluntly informed by one director, "We're out. After the way Mr. Rockefeller has been treated by the state of Texas, he'll never put another dime in Texas." Standard had to sit back and suffer the emergence of a host of competing producers, including Gulf Oil and the Texas Company, later called Texaco. So while reformers noisily denounced the omnipotence of Standard Oil, its monopoly was swiftly crumbling at home and overseas. With additional oil strikes in California, Indian Territory, later Oklahoma, Kansas, and Illinois in the early 1900s, the industry became too vast and far-flung for even Standard Oil to control. It might not be too much of an exaggeration to say that the antitrust cases brought against the Trust in the early 1900s were not just belated, but were fast becoming superfluous. After a young anarchist assassinated William McKinley in Buffalo in September 1901, the country was swept by widespread trepidation that the shooting had formed part of a broader conspiracy. In Chicago, a traveling salesman captivated reporters with tales of a conversation he had overheard at a local train depot, where J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller were mentioned as potential assassination targets. A heavily armed contingent of guards ringed Rockefeller's residence, and he remained incommunicado.
As it turned out, the gravest threat to the Titans' welfare emanated not from shadowy, gun-toting subversives, but from the new White House occupant, 43-year-old Theodore Roosevelt. So long as McKinley was in the White House, Rockefeller had implicit faith that his business interests would be safeguarded. "America is truly to be congratulated upon Mr. McKinley's election," he had written in November 1900. "With financial interests on a sound basis, the next 4 years ought to accomplish much for the general welfare of the American people." In Roosevelt, however, whom he credited as the shrewdest of politicians, Rockefeller knew he had a formidable rival. In a political world degraded by corrupt bosses and ward healers, Teddy Roosevelt was that rara avis, a cultivated, well-to-do man. Descended from Dutch settlers who had emigrated to New Amsterdam before 1648 and later made a fortune in Manhattan real estate, Roosevelt, like many of his social peers, was scandalized by the sordid ethics of the new industrial class. As a New York State Assemblyman in 1883, this aristocratic renegade reviled Jay Gould and his ilk as members of the wealthy criminal class, the first of many such rhetorical blasts. In 1886, Rockefeller contributed $1,000 to Roosevelt's unsuccessful mayoral campaign, only because he feared even more the single tax policy espoused by one of his opponents, Henry George. Running for New York governor in 1898, Roosevelt accepted contributions from Henry Flagler and a number of Wall Street executives, whom he promptly double-crossed by enacting a tax on corporate franchises and supporting factory regulation. A militant preacher against class divisions, he warned that politicians ignored popular discontent about the trusts at their peril. "If they stuck to laissez-faire neglect," he predicted, "then the multitudes will follow the crank who advocates an absurd policy, but who does advocate something." A dyspeptic Henry Flagler spluttered, "I have no command of the English language that enables me to express my feelings regarding Mr. Roosevelt." New York businessmen were so eager to get rid of Roosevelt that they eased him out of the governorship and into the vice presidential slot on the McKinley ticket in 1900. Roosevelt always believed that Standard Oil had formed part of the effort to export him from state politics. By 1901, virtually all American industrialists were converts to the doctrine of cooperation preached by Rockefeller, and feared Teddy Roosevelt's reputation as a trustbuster, even if that anxiety was somewhat overblown. Like Rockefeller, the new president favored industrial consolidation to exploit economies of scale. Scoffing at calls by William Jennings Bryan and Robert La Follette to dismantle the trusts, he contended that any such course would thwart the economy's natural tendency. "Much of the legislation not only proposed but enacted against trusts is not one whit more intelligent than the medieval bull against the comet, and has not been one particle more effective." Roosevelt distinguished between bad trusts, which gouged consumers, and good trusts, which offered fair prices and good service. Instead of indiscriminate trust busting, he concentrated on the worst offenders, and he singled out Standard Oil as emblematic of the abusive trusts. When Roosevelt became president, Mark Hanna urged him to reassure skittish businessmen by avoiding provocative statements. With mischievous relish, the young president threw a dinner for J.P. Morgan, telling one cabinet member, "You see, it represents an effort on my part to become a conservative man in touch with the influential class, and I think I deserve encouragement." He sought the advice of Senator Aldrich and stayed on his best behavior around businessmen. In November 1901, after a friendly meeting with Roosevelt, an aide to Henry Flagler suggested that he meet with the president and patch up hard feelings between them. "I don't believe there is a man in America who dreads such a thing as much as I do," Flagler responded. "I am glad you saw him, for I am sure I don't want to do it." The statement captured the hubris that would soon be the downfall of Standard Oil, which treated the federal government as a meddlesome, inferior power. Roosevelt rode a tightrope between radical reformers and trust kings. He had a clever way of delivering sharp, sudden blows against business, then following with conciliatory speeches. By nature, he was a political hybrid, Strident reformers brought out his conservatism, while standpat businessmen brought out his crusading zeal. Much like Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s, he introduced regulation in order to save the country from social unrest and forestall more extreme measures. He was accused of appropriating the policies of William Jennings Bryan, much as Franklin Roosevelt was later said to have undercut his left-wing critics by appropriating many of their policies. In February 1902, as businessmen speculated about his true colors, Roosevelt showed that he had not mellowed. Without consulting Wall Street, he launched an antitrust suit against the Northern Securities Company, a holding company created by J.P. Morgan to consolidate railroads in the Pacific Northwest. Stunned businessmen sold stocks on the news. However aggrieved, J.P. Morgan did not declare open warfare on Roosevelt, and later in the year helped him arbitrate an end to the anthracite coal strike. As Roosevelt turned the presidency into an honest broker between capital and labor, Morgan, unlike the more myopic Rockefeller, saw that Roosevelt stood ready to make concessions to cooperative businessmen. In early 1903, Roosevelt supported the Elkins Act, which strengthened penalties for railroad rebates, and energetically promoted plans for a new Department of Commerce and Labor, which would include a Bureau of Corporations with broad powers to investigate the trusts. The new bureau was indispensable to his antitrust program, since the federal government was too small and thinly staffed to tackle the trusts on anything like an equal basis. In the 1890s, the entire Justice Department staff in Washington had only 18 lawyers. To take on the industrial giants, Roosevelt needed more staff and, especially, more information. As business interests fought the Bureau, Roosevelt artfully manipulated the press to demonize his foes. In February 1903, he informed reporters that six senators had received telegrams from John D. Rockefeller urging defeat of the proposed Bureau in these words: "We are opposed to the antitrust legislation. Our counsel will see you. It must be stopped. John D. Rockefeller." This mighty revelation, as Roosevelt expected, caused a terrific commotion. Rockefeller's name was now shorthand for corporate villainy, so that his opposition to the Bureau appeared conclusively to prove its need. As Teddy Roosevelt exclaimed jubilantly, "I got the bill through by publishing those telegrams and concentrating public attention on the bill." In truth, the telegrams were sent by Junior after prodding from Archbold. Shocked and embarrassed by the uproar, Junior resented Archbold for having dragged him into the ill-advised lobbying operation. That everybody believed his revered father had authored the telegrams only made it the more mortifying. "I came out of college something of an idealist," he later reflected, "and I was immediately thrust into the tough give-and-take of the business world. I really wasn't ready for it." No stranger to controversy, Rockefeller told his son to ignore his critics. "Let the world wag," he said. But Junior kept brooding. He desperately wanted to rehabilitate the family name and live an irreproachable life. And here he was already wading hip-deep in Standard Oil muck. It was one of several events that finally convinced him that he was too squeamish for a business career. Fiercely self-righteous, Teddy Roosevelt never forgot Standard Oil's attempt to sabotage his new department. But he was a practical politician and recognized the value of winning Standard Oil support in his 1904 election campaign. Trying to mediate a truce between Standard Oil and the White House, Congressman Joseph C. Sibley told Archbold that the president thought the oil trust was hostile toward him, to which Archbold said facetiously, "I have always been an admirer of President Roosevelt, and have read every book he ever wrote, and have them in the best bindings in my library." Sibley relayed this flattering news to Roosevelt, minus, of course, the sarcasm. "The book business fetched down the game at the very first shot," Sibley reported back to Archbold. "You had better read at least the titles of those volumes to refresh your memory before you come over." The rapprochement did not survive the 1904 election, for once the voting was over, the president had an unpleasant surprise in store for Standard Oil.
In stalking Standard Oil, Teddy Roosevelt had no more potent ally than the press. In the spring of 1900, Rockefeller could still reassure a correspondent that favorable publicity about him overshadowed adverse coverage. No man can succeed in any calling without provoking the jealousy and envy of some, he observed. The strong, level-headed man will go straight forward and do his work, and history will rightly record. Several trends gave birth to a newly assertive press. The gigantic trusts swelled the ranks of national advertisers, fattening the pages of many periodicals. Aided by new technologies, including linotype and photo engraving, glossy illustrated magazines streamed forth in such numbers that the era would be memorialized as the golden age of the American magazine. Paralleling this was the rise of mass circulation newspapers, which catered to an expanding reading public. Competing in fierce circulation wars, Joseph Pulitzer, William Randolph Hearst, and other press barons plied readers with scandals and crusades. Nonetheless, the turn of the century marked more than the heyday of strident tabloids and yellow journalism. As sophisticated publications began to tackle complex stories, illustrating them lavishly and promoting them aggressively. For the first time in history, college graduates went to work on newspapers and magazines, bringing a new literary flair to a world once considered beneath the dignity of the educated elite. Studded with star writers and editors, the most impressive periodical was McClure's magazine, which was started by Samuel S. McClure in 1893. In September 1901, the same month that Roosevelt ascended to the presidency, the magazine's managing editor, Ida Minerva Tarbell, sailed to Europe to confer with McClure, then taking a rest from his strenuous life in Vevey, Switzerland. In her suitcase, she carried an outline for a three-part series on the Standard Oil Company. Though she wondered whether anyone would ever wade through a long factual account of a business empire, a journalistic enterprise never essayed before. The Standard Oil story was intertwined with Tarbell's early life. Born in 1857 in a log cabin 30 miles from where Drake struck oil 2 years later, she was a true daughter of the oil regions. I had grown up with oil derricks, oil tanks, pipelines, refineries, oil exchanges, she wrote in her memoirs. Her father, Franklin Tarbell, crafted vats from hemlock bark, a trade easily converted into barrel-making after Drake's discovery. The Tarbells lived beside his Rouseville barrel shop, and Ida, as a child, rolled luxuriously in the heaps of pine shavings. Down the hill from her house, across a ravine, lived an amiable young refiner named Henry H. Rogers, who later recalled seeing the young girl picking wildflowers on the slope. Ida watched men with queer gleams in their eyes swarming through Rouseville en route to the miracle-turned-mirage of Pithole Creek. Franklin Tarbell set up a barrel shop there and cashed in on the boom before Pithole's oil gave out. But Franklin's prosperity was tenuous, based on an antiquated technology. Wooden barrels were soon replaced by iron tanks, the first of several times that Ida's father was hurt by progress. He then sought his fortune as an independent oil producer and refiner, just as Rockefeller was consolidating the industry and snuffing out small operators. In 1872, as an impressionable 15-year-old, Ida saw her paradise torn asunder by the South Improvement Company. As her father joined vigilantes who sabotaged the conspirators' tanks, she thrilled to the talk of revolution. "On the instant, the word became holy to me," she later wrote. The SIC darkened her sunlit world. The father who once sang, played the Jew's harp, and told funny stories became a silent and stern man, breeding in his sensitive daughter a lifelong hatred of Standard Oil. For her, Standard Oil symbolized the triumph of grasping men over decent folk, like her father, who played fair and square. She remembered the Titusville of her teenage years as divided between the valiant majority who resisted the octopus and the small band of opportunists who defected to it. On the street, Franklin pointed out turncoats to his daughter. "In those days I looked with more contempt on the man who had gone over to the Standard than on the one who had been in jail," she said.
After a time, Franklin's family would not speak to blackguards who had sold out to Rockefeller. It revolted Ida that the trust could turn proud, independent entrepreneurs into beaten men taking orders from distant bosses. Although Tarbell had a more genteel upbringing than Rockefeller, with more books, magazines, and small luxuries, one is struck by the similarity of the Rockefellers' Baptist and the Tarbells' Methodist households. The straight-laced Franklin Tarbell forbade cards and dancing and supported many causes, including the temperance movement. Ida attended prayer meetings on Thursday nights and taught an infant class of the Sunday school. Shy and bookish, she tended, like Rockefeller, to arrive at brilliant solutions by slow persistence. What set Tarbell apart from Rockefeller was her intellectual daring and fearless curiosity. As a teenager, despite her family's fundamentalism, she tried to prove the truth of evolution. By the time she enrolled at Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania, in 1876, she was the sole girl in the freshman class of this Methodist school. She loved to peer through microscopes and planned to become a biologist. What distinguished her as a journalist was how she united a scientific attention to detail with homegrown moral fervor. After graduation, Tarbell taught for 2 years at the Poland Union Seminary in Poland, Ohio, then got a job on the editorial staff of the Chautauquan, an offshoot of the summer adult education movement, which originated as a Methodist camp meeting. The fiery, militant Christian spirit of the movement made Ida even more high-minded in her expectations. Tall and attractive, with dark hair, large gray eyes, and high cheekbones, Tarbell had an erect carriage and innate dignity, and never lacked suitors. Yet she decided never to marry and to remain self-sufficient. She steeled herself against any feelings that might compromise her ambitions or integrity, and she walked through life, perhaps a little self-consciously, in a shining moral armor. In 1891, the 34-year-old Tarbell moved to Paris with friends and set up bohemian quarters on the Left Bank, an unusually courageous decision for a young American woman at the time. She was determined to write a biography of the Girondist Madame Roland while selling freelance articles to Pennsylvania and Ohio newspapers and attending classes at the Sorbonne. Hard-working and level-headed, she mailed off 2 articles during her first week in Paris alone. Even though the prim Tarbell was taken aback when lascivious Frenchmen flirted with her, she adored her time in Paris. She interviewed eminent Parisians, ranging from Louis Pasteur to Émile Zola, for American newspapers, and won many admirers for her clean, accurate reportage. She claimed that her writing had absorbed some of the beauty and clarity of the French language. Still, she struggled on the ragged edge of bankruptcy and was susceptible when McClure wooed her as an editor of his new magazine. While she was still in Paris, 2 events occurred that would lend an emotional tinge to her Standard Oil series. One Sunday afternoon in June 1892, she found herself roaming the Paris streets, unable to shake off a sense of doom. Later that afternoon, she read in the Paris newspapers that Titusville and Oil City had been ravaged by flood and fire, with 150 people either drowned or burned to death. The next day, her brother Will sent a single-word cable, safe, relieving her anxieties, but the event reinforced a guilty feeling that she had neglected her family. In 1893, one of her father's oil partners shot himself in despair because of poor business, forcing Franklin Tarbell to mortgage his house to settle the debts he inherited. Ida's sister was in the hospital at the time, and here was I across the ocean writing picayune pieces at 1/4 of a cent a word while they struggled there, she later recalled. I felt guilty, and the only way I had kept myself up to what I had undertaken was the hope that I could eventually make a substantial return. While in Paris, Ida Tarbell laid hands on a copy of Wealth Against Commonwealth, where she rediscovered the author of her father's woes, John D. Rockefeller. Once in New York in 1894, Tarbell published 2 biographies in serial form that might have predisposed her to focus on a single figure at Standard Oil. Anticipating her portrait of Rockefeller, she presented Napoleon as a gifted megalomaniac, a great but flawed man lacking that fine sense of proportion which holds the rights of others in the same solemn reverence which it demands for its own. Lifted by this series, McClure's circulation leaped from 24,500 in late 1894 to more than 100,000 in early 1895. Then followed Tarbell's celebrated 20-part series on Lincoln, which absorbed 4 years of her life, 1895 to 1899, and boosted the magazine's circulation to 300,000. She honed her investigative skills as she excavated dusty documents and forgotten courthouse records. In 1899, after being named managing editor of McClure's, Tarbell took an apartment in Greenwich Village and befriended many literary notables, including Mark Twain, who would soon provide her with entree to Henry H. Hellhound Rogers. By this time, having sharpened her skills, she was set to publish one of the most influential pieces of journalism in American business history. The idea of writing about Standard Oil had fermented in her mind for many years before she worked for McClure's. Years ago, when I dreamed of someday writing fiction, I had planned to write the great American novel, having the Standard Oil Company as a backbone. After receiving McClure's blessing, Ida Tarbell launched the series in November 1902, feeding the American public rich monthly servings of Rockefeller's past misdeeds. She went back to the early Cleveland days and laid out his whole career for careful inspection. All the depredations of a long career, everything Rockefeller had thought safely buried and forgotten, rose up before him in haunting and memorable detail. Before she was done, Ida Tarbell turned America's most private man into its most public and hated figure. The inspiration for publishing The Anatomy of a Major Trust came from Samuel McClure, one of the most gifted windbags ever to occupy an editorial chair, who recruited writers with marathon speeches about his magazine's greatness. High-strung, mercurial, seized by hourly brainstorms, McClure was described by Rudyard Kipling as a cyclone in a frock coat. Moving through life at breakneck speed, he seemed forever to be veering toward a nervous collapse. When McClure first materialized in Tarbell's Paris apartment in 1892, he appeared distracted and breathless. "I've just 10 minutes," he told her, checking his watch. "Must leave for Switzerland tonight to see English physicist John Tyndall." Eager to sign up this startled young woman, the man with the tousled sandy hair and electric blue eyes stayed for 3 hours. Able, methodical people grow on every bush, but genius comes once in a generation, and if you ever get in its vicinity, thank the Lord and stick, Tarbell once told a colleague apropos of McClure. That McClure hired a young, relatively inexperienced woman as his first full-time staff writer attests to his unorthodox style. He would collar every talented young writer in America, Frank Norris, Stephen Crane, Theodore Dreiser, Willa Cather, as well as more established figures such as Mark Twain and Rudyard Kipling. O. Henry, Damon Runyon, and Booth Tarkington debuted in his pages. Yet it was perhaps in nonfiction that McClure left his most lasting imprint, for the best investigative reporters, from Lincoln Steffens to Ray Stannard Baker, gravitated to the magazine. Of his first office visit, Baker reminisced, "Even with S.S. McClure absent, I was in the most stimulating, yes, intoxicating editorial atmosphere then existent in America, or anywhere else." McClure watched over the creative chaos like a restless genie. "I can't sit still," he once told Lincoln Steffens. "That's your job. I don't see how you can do it." Amid this swirling lunacy, Ida Tarbell sat in her high collar and shirtwaist dress, a model of calm sanity. As Lincoln Steffens recalled, she would come to the office, smiling like a tall, good-looking young mother to say, "Hush, children." A man with a weakness for big, startling facts, McClure commissioned articles on new gadgets, scientific research, and futuristic technologies. This penchant for facts enabled him to spot Tarbell's talent for enlivening a dry subject when she wrote an entertaining article about the paving of Parisian streets. Instead of the scandal-mongering being offered by Pulitzer or Hearst, McClure wanted to analyze complex issues and explore them with scientific precision. Aiming at a comprehensive critique of American society, McClure concluded by 1901 the two great issues confronted the country, the growth of industrial trusts and political corruption. Before long, Lincoln Steffens was digging out municipal corruption in a series entitled The Shame of the Cities that started to run in October 1902. In the February 24, 1905 issue, he skewered Senator Aldrich in a piece on Rhode Island corruption. The choice of the proper trust to expose was a trickier issue. At first, Tarbell contemplated the Steel Trust and the Sugar Trust before the discovery of oil in California turned her attention to Standard Oil as the most perfectly developed trust. Since it had been investigated by various government bodies for three decades, it had left a rich documentary trail. At first projected for three issues, the Standard Oil series eventually stretched by popular demand to 19 installments. It was inaugurated in November 1902 against an especially timely backdrop. An anthracite coal strike during the winter of 1902 to 1903 deprived the poor of coal, forcing them to heat their homes with oil, and the subsequent sharp rise in oil prices made energy an incendiary issue. Although Tarbell pretended to apply her scalpel to Standard Oil with surgical objectivity, she was never neutral, and not only because of her father. Her brother, William Walter Tarbell, had been a leading figure in forming the Pure Oil Company, the most serious domestic challenger to Standard Oil, and his letters to her were laced with anti-standard venom. Complaining of the trust's price manipulations in one letter, Will warned her, "Some of those fellows will get killed one of those days." As Pure Oil's treasurer in 1902, Will steered legions of Rockefeller enemies to his sister and even vetted her manuscripts. Far from cherishing her neutrality, Tarbell in the end adhered to the advice she had once received from Henry James. Cherish your contempts. Amazingly enough, nobody made an issue of Tarbell's veritable partnership with her brother in exposing his chief competitor. When Franklin Tarbell heard that his daughter was taking on the mighty Standard, he warned her that she was exposing herself to extreme danger. "Don't do it, Ida. They will ruin the magazine," he said, and even broached the possibility they might maim or murder her. A far-fetched scenario, but suggestive of the dread that the trust inspired. As her research began, she made a sentimental trip to Titusville, which rekindled her old animosity toward Standard Oil. Her father was slowly dying of stomach cancer while she was writing her series, and this might have further embittered her toward Rockefeller, however unfairly. Franklin Tarbell would die on March 1, 1905. Contrary to her father's predictions, Ida inflicted far more damage on Standard Oil than she received in return. The closest she came to being threatened was at a Washington dinner party where Frank Vanderlip, a vice president of National City Bank, drew her into a side room to voice his strong displeasure with her project. Sensing a vague financial menace to McClure's, she retorted, "Well, I am sorry, but of course that makes no difference to me." In fact, what was most notable about Standard Oil's response was its haughty, self-defeating silence. Tarbell approached her work methodically, like a carpenter, but she soon reeled under the weight of documentary evidence. After a week spent combing through reports of the Industrial Commission in February 1902, she wrote despairingly, "The task confronting me is such a monstrous one that I am staggering a bit under it." By June, having completed three installments, she confessed that the material had acquired an obsessive hold over her mind and even invaded her sleep. On the eve of a needed European vacation, she told her research assistant, It has become a great bugbear to me. I dream of the octopus by night and think of nothing else by day, and I shall be glad to exchange it for the Alps.
Upon her return from vacation, she met with Henry Demarest Lloyd at his seaside estate in Saconnet, Rhode Island. He insisted that, despite the Interstate Commerce Commission, large shippers were still getting the same old freight rebates, although they carefully destroyed the evidence. He told her, barely containing his rage, that Rockefeller and his associates embodied the most dangerous tendencies in modern life. At one point, when he learned that Ida Tarbell had met with Henry H. Rogers, Lloyd thought she might be in cahoots with the company and warned his Pennsylvania contacts to watch out for her. His doubts were instantly dispelled as the series got underway. "When you get through with Johnny," he applauded her in April 1903, "I don't think there will be very much left of him, except something resembling one of his own grease spots." In the end, Lloyd handed over his abundant notes to her and urged George Rice, Lewis Emery, and other independents to talk with her. Having passed the torch, Henry Demarest Lloyd died in September 1903 before the series was finished. Shortly before Tarbell began her research, Sam McClure tried to coax Mark Twain into editing the magazine, but Henry H. Rogers persuaded Twain to resist. As early as December 1901, almost a year before the series started to run, Rogers spotted an ad announcing McClure's forthcoming series on Standard Oil, and was startled that nobody at 26 Broadway had been contacted by the author. Concerned, he wrote to Twain, "It would naturally be supposed that any person desiring to write a veritable history would seek for information as near original sources as possible." Fearing that Tarbell might be consorting with the enemy, Rogers suggested that Twain tell McClure that he should verify all statements with the Trust before they were published. When Twain pressed for details about the series, McClure balked, saying, "You will have to ask Miss Tarbell." To which Twain replied, "Would Miss Tarbell see Mr. Rogers?" Tarbell had, of course, hoped to interview the top brass at Standard Oil, and when McClure burst into her office with the invitation, she was eager to seize the chance. A veteran charmer, Hellhound Rogers, invited Tarbell for a two-hour chat at his home on East 57th Street. She had never met a real captain of industry before, and seemed entranced by his resemblance to Twain. His big head with its high forehead was set off by a heavy shock of beautiful gray hair. His nose was aquiline, sensitive, she wrote, still betraying admiration years later. Rogers seduced her with nostalgic recollections of the days when they were Rouseville neighbors. "That reminiscence of Henry H. Rogers is only one of several reasons I have for heartily liking as fine a pirate as ever flew his flag in Wall Street." The upshot of the meeting was that Tarbell agreed to give Rogers a chance to react to any revelations she unearthed, and for 2 years she periodically visited him at 26 Broadway. These encounters had a quasi-clandestine aura, with the reporter whisked in one door and out another. In a spirit of guarded cooperation, Samuel Dodd assembled material for Tarbell, while Daniel O'Day passed along information on pipelines. Since Tarbell had spoken with Rogers for nearly a year before the series started, she held her breath when the first issue appeared in November 1902. "I rather expected him to cut me off when he realized that I was trying to prove that the Standard Oil Company was only an enlarged South Improvement Company." To her astonishment, Rogers still received her, and while occasionally miffed by this or that article, he remained on friendly terms with her. Rogers's complacence has always been a huge mystery, engendering two schools of thought. Tarbell cited Rogers's self-interest. He and Archbold had been stung by accusations that they had conspired to blow up a Buffalo refinery that competed with Standard Oil. "That case is a sore point with Mr. Archbold and me," he immediately told Tarbell. "I want you to go into it thoroughly." Responding to his heightened sensitivity on this matter, she agreed to let him review anything she wrote about it. Rogers's strategy paid off as far as the Buffalo imbroglio was concerned.
In Tarbell's view, Rogers was willing to see Standard Oil's reputation sullied as long as his own was preserved. Another school of thought hypothesized that Rogers was both deflecting attention from his own misdeeds and taking revenge against Rockefeller, who had disapproved of his stock market speculations. This argument suggests that Rogers enjoyed Tarbell's series as a rebuke to his colleague's sanctimony. Rockefeller privately denounced Rogers as a traitor who had fed Tarbell false, garbled information to defame him. Many years later, after a confidential chat with John D. Rockefeller, Jr., Alan Nevins recorded in a memo, "Jr. thinks that Rogers's part in the publication of Ida Tarbell's book was far from unselfish, that he was secretly glad to see Rockefeller attacked and supplied some of the material." Tarbell's own notes reveal that, while Rogers often defended Rockefeller, he also kept the spotlight tightly focused on the founder and away from himself. Rogers did not terminate his meetings with Tarbell until February 1904, when she published a shocking account of railway agents spying on Standard Oil competitors, a practice